All right, then. Let's do some Dharma. A few weeks ago, I get this magazine from Spirit Rock Meditation Center, and there was an interview in there. It's this place where I went through their 2.5-year seminary program about 15 years ago, the Community Dharma Leaders Training Program that Don Morreale's also gone through. And it was our great good fortune in that program to have as one of our teachers a Western monk named Ajahn Amaro. And Ajahn Amaro is from the same lineage, the Thai forest tradition, as Jack Kornfield and some of the other Western teachers. But while the other Western teachers, like Jack and Joseph and Sharon and Guy Armstrong and whatnot, who had, some of whom would practice as monks and nuns when they were in Asia, when they returned to the West, then they also returned to the more of the kind of the householders or lay way of life, although they were spending all their time teaching the Dharma, mostly drawn from the texts of the Theravada Buddhist tradition. Some, however, who were started practicing there at about the same time, in Ajahn Amaro's case, it was about sometime in the early 1970s, decided to stay in Rhodes. And they've lived their entire lives as Theravada monastics ever since. And so after about 20 or 25 years at Ajahn Chah's Thai Forest Meditation Center in rural eastern Thailand, Ajahn Amaro returned to the West. And he was briefly part of the monastic community in England, and then Ajahn Sumedho, the sort of the senior monk there, suggested that he come start teaching the Dharma in the United States. So he moved to the U.S. He founded a small monastery up in Northern California, in the Central Valley near the Oregon border, and eventually joined the teaching faculty and the board of directors of Spirit Rock. And one of the really wonderful things about having Ajahn Amaro as one of our teachers was that being a monk in Rhodes, you know, he was teaching from the place of being a 225 precept monk, you know, which is different than being a layperson teaching the Dharma. Same Dharma, but coming at it from a somewhat different vantage point. And one of the sort of enduring themes of Ajahn Amaro's, when he came to the West and started teaching, he said a couple of things. One, he said that he was really impressed with the amount of intensive retreat practice that was going on here in the United States. All the long-term residential meditation retreats, intensive silent retreats that were being held all over the country, and so many yogis who were really becoming quite well-grounded in a concentrated, mindful meditation practice and were really getting a deep grasp of the Dharma. And as we know, this Dharma wheel here on the altar is a depiction of the Eightfold Path, of the teaching that the Buddha gave on how to achieve spiritual freedom, how to the path to enlightenment. The first three spokes in the wheel are the meditative factors, the samadhi factors, of concentration, that is training the mind to be still and focused with sustained attention. Effort, you know, skillful effort put into practice, and the cultivation of mindfulness. Those factors working together create a foundation for, a fertile soil for, the arising of the next two factors in the Eightfold Path, which are called the wisdom factors. Okay. And one of those wisdom factors is skillful, useful, beneficial, right understanding, which is essentially a deep grasp of oneself in a karmic sense, all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are in the moment, and some notion of how we co-create the environment with each other, how we co-create ourselves. Okay. So, that understanding, that deep understanding of where we come from, or thinking how the mind conjures self, how the mind conjures the world, you know, is a really important wisdom factor. The other important wisdom factor, right understanding, the other one is right intention, which is to say, before one speaks or acts, the ability to reflect upon the motivations that underlie the proposed speech or action. Is the intention underlying the speech or action mostly grounded in ill will or greed or delusion, or is it mostly grounded in generosity and wisdom and kind regard? And then that state of mind, that intention, is the one that predisposes us to speak and act in certain ways. And then, of course, the last three, and those are the panya factors, the wisdom factors, the last three factors are the factors that are variously described as the morality factors or the virtue factors or the conduct factors. The three is sila, and one of the lead English translators of the Pali Canon has essentially said that the root meaning of that collective term sila, wiser, right speech, understanding, way of life, is to live in harmony with oneself, with others, and with the environment, in a way that leads to the cessation of suffering instead of the perpetuation of suffering. And one of the teachings at Amaro, or one of the observations that he made a lot, he said, you know, it seems that here in the United States, you've really got the first two sets of factors down pat. You know, you've got all these retreats going on, and people are really developing deep samadhi and concentration, right effort, and although you get a little carried away sometimes, and mindfulness being well grounded. Insight into the Dharma, insight into, you know, what the Buddha had to teach, insight into how we bring ourselves into being with our thoughts. And then, of course, growing insight into the intention that precedes action. So I think where things are a little off, he said, here in the West, you know, especially in the United States, it's kind of a lopsided Dharma wheel. Because those three sila factors are not really as robustly developed. That there's not really as much attention being paid in the West to how one actualizes the Dharma in daily life, how one actualizes the Dharma in social action, you know, in interaction with others, how one actualizes the Dharma and how we literally live. So a good deal of his teaching, you know, and what he was doing, he was training this cohort of people in this program that Don and I and many others have gone through. Because what had been happening up until then in the 70s into the 80s is that people would go away on retreats and then they'd come back home again, and there's this kind of abrupt dichotomy between their retreat experience and coming back into daily life. And so the sitting groups that began to form around the country were ones that would kind of try to keep you on a maintenance dose until you could go on your next retreat again, right? But not a whole lot more than that. You just get together and sit, kind of end the story. One of the reasons they established the program that Don and I went through was the idea that what really did need to be happening here in the West, especially in the United States, was the development of more robust spiritual communities at the local level to sustain the Dharma in a better informed and deeper and more meaningful and more continuous way than had been the case before. And so I think there are several hundred of us that have been trained now. And at the last meeting of Insight Meditation Sanghas around the country, I think there are like 120 leaders or so. Almost half of those sitting groups meet in Unitarian churches. we're among the oldest. You know, we've been sitting together here now for 18 years. So what is beginning to come to fruition is the very thing that Amaro was putting his finger on, which is to say, okay, how do we as a community really try to focus our attention and our energy on following the Buddha's advice with regard to living the Dharma? And as it turns out, there are several discourses in those 5,000 plus printed words of the English transcriptions of the Buddha's teachings in which he did just that. So one of the discourses that Ajahn Amaro recommends and actually discusses in this article in this magazine is one from the collection of discourses called the Numerical Discourses. There are not great flowery thematic titles for these collections of the Buddha's teachings, the transcripts of the from the Pali of the Buddha's teachings. Basically, there are these very pedestrian descriptive titles instead. So the Buddha's teachings, the transcripts, are divided up into this set of books called the Nikayas. Nikaya just means collection. So there's the collection of the long discourses, and there's a collection of the medium length discourses and the short discourses, and there's a collection of the discourses that bear some thematic relationship to each other, the connected discourses, Samyutta Nikaya. The most frequently relied upon Nikaya probably is the Majjhima Nikaya, or the middle of the discourses. And then the Buddha taught in a very methodical way. He compiled hundreds and hundreds of lists of things. You know, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, you know, we sing a song every holiday about, you know, about all the, some of the Buddha's lists. And the Numerical Discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, is just a collection of lists. The list of the twos, the list of the fours, the list of the fives, the list of the sevens. In the lists of the sevens, in section 68, we find something. It's a discourse on, it's called The One Who Knows the Dharma. And Ajahn Amaro teaches this discourse and pays attention to it because he says it's where the Buddha explicates or really provides a lot more detail at the interface between intention and action. And so it's a wisdom factor, well, they're both wisdom factors actually. He said you need to develop a certain amount of knowledge, okay, including self-knowledge, insight into your own tendencies, your own behaviors, you know, including this as well as substantive factual knowledge of the Dharma, in order to be able to effectively live the Dharma so that it transforms your own life and so that your very being can have a transformative or beneficial effect on those around you. And so in this list of the sevens, actually, as I read it, it really had even the words the Buddha used, it started to sound to me kind of like a mixture between classical Greek philosophy and Danny Goldman's writings on emotional and social intelligence. He's really going into a fair amount of detail about how important it is to know yourself, how important it is to have insights into the motives of others, how important it is to really have an understanding of who it is you're talking to. You know, when the Buddha was advising his followers to go forth and began to teach, there are these precepts that they took. And one of the precepts he had them take was the one that says, I shall teach a graduated discourse. And what he meant by that is that you don't give a graduate's level lecture to beginners. You know, you discern what people's level of understanding and interest is, and you remark accordingly. Okay, so here's this list of seven. The first one, he said, if you're going to be able to have a beneficial effect in your contact with others with regard to the Dharma, it's probably a pretty good idea if you know something about the Dharma. If you actually have a little baseline knowledge there, right, you know, have a little understanding of what the Four Noble Truths are, you know, suffering, origin, suffering, cessation, the means by which cessation is achieved. And then, of course, the fourth one is the Eightfold Path. You know, I have some understanding of the samadhi factors, of the wisdom factors, of the virtuous conduct factors. Furthermore, not just to have, be able to rattle those things off, be able to memorize the language or have content, but to understand, to realize the meaning of those words. Not just to really get an experiential, deep level understanding for yourself, but also to be able to understand when you're in conversation with others, what the impact of your words are on them, what the impact of their words and their questions and whatnot are on you. So being able to discern meaning, being able to discern the meaning below the level of simple speech is another one. The third one on his list that he talks about is knowing yourself. He said, in order to be an effective, skilled student of the Dharma, you need to have a certain amount of self-knowledge, self-awareness. So for instance, in the Buddhist system of psychology, they talk about the three kalesas, the three torments of the mind, greed, hatred, and delusion. Then we have all got them. You know, the hand we all got dealt has got those cards in it. There's just no way around it. How we play them, or how we choose not to, is of course what the Dharma is all about. And one understanding of personalities from the standpoint of Theravada Buddhism is that while we're all imbued with these qualities, as well as the beneficial ones, like wisdom and generosity and kindness and compassion, you know, that our personalities tend to be affected karmically by those three torments of the mind to one degree or another. And for most of us, one of those is stronger than the others. So in this psychology system, there's talk about the aversive person. You tend to be a person who is kind of predisposed or inclined to be suspicious or anxious or wary or just kind of negatively inclined. You know, when you first meet somebody, the first thing the mind seeks to do is call out all the things you don't like about them. Whether it's their appearance or how they talk or what they have to say. So the aversive personality, the greedy personality, the one that feels they're always coming from a place of hunger. They always need something they don't have. They always need one. Or the deluded type, the deluded personality, the one that basically just prefers not to see a lot of what's going on around them. So, and again, this is just a typology. It's tendencies, it's not predispositions, it's not how you're condemned to live out your life. But it is a set of kind of diagnostics. So you can reflect a little bit on, overall, do I tend to be more of an aversive personality, or, you know, an avaricious one, or a deluded one? So it's just one means of having a little self-knowledge. Do you find yourself quick to anger? Do you find yourself sort of quick to apologize, you know? There's that line from it, there's that play that became a movie, I think, called 1,000 Clowns, where this guy he goes out and does this exercise where he stands on the corner and everyone comes by and says, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And after a while, people would come by and he'd say, I'm sorry. And they'd say, that's all right. So going forth, it's really useful or helpful to know a little bit about who you are. Do I tend to be shy? Do I tend to be extroverted? Do I tend to be kind of expansive in the fellow room? Do I tend to more shrink into a corner? And, you know, Garrison Keillor said once, on Saturday Night Live once, there's this just in, Garrison Keillor just gave his 1,000th interview about being a shy person. You know? But he says that inside every shy person, there is a raving egomaniac. There's somebody that wants to birth force and say, I am Ra, the sun god. Bow before me. So, yeah, how do we tend to fall in the scheme of things, right? So, a little bit of self-knowledge about the nature of our being, how we tend to interact with others. The better knowledge we have of ourselves, the more effective we're going to be in communicating. Knowledge of what the Buddha called the right amount. And he explained this in various ways. The right amount of food, the right amount of rest, the right amount of solitude, the right amount of social interaction. Things that all need to be held in balance with each other. Okay. Knowing when it's time for a conversation to end. Knowing when it's useful for something to be said. Okay. So a sense of timing, that's the fourth factor. The fifth one that he spoke about is knowing when is the appropriate time for certain words or deeds to occur. Okay. You don't tell yo mama jokes at your friend's mom's funeral. A sense of what's appropriate, you know, when, under what circumstance. So, when it is appropriate to do what. So there may be things that are appropriate to be done, but getting the timing right is really pretty important. In addition to knowing oneself, the Buddha said it's equally important to know your audience, which is to say, to know the kind of people with whom you are speaking. Ajahn Amaro in his talks, he talks about, you know, being able to distinguish between graduate students and first graders, you know, what their level of ability is, what their level of, you know, what their capacity is, what their needs are at the time, right? So, in this understanding, one's ability as an empath, you know, in terms of emotional and social intelligence, is being attuned to those we are with. And in this understanding, there is a really important relationship between our ability to really know and understand ourselves and our ability to know and understand others. Because the better tuned in we are to ourselves, how do I feel? How do I look when I'm frightened, or when I'm angry, or when I'm sad, or when I'm happy? And then being able to discern those kinds of emotions in others, okay, to develop some kind of intuitive connection with them. Okay. This is all non-verbal interconnecting, right? That in the Buddha's teaching is quite crucial to being able to convey and to live the Dharma. And the reason he said that is that and Ajahn Amaro says this a lot too, he said, it is your state of being more than anything else, more than anything you say, more than the individual action, just how you are in the world, how you regard yourself and speak about yourself, how you regard others and speak about them. But just one state of being that is, and for the most part, is the most powerful teaching of all. Okay. So we are all teaching all the time, whether we want to be, whether we know it or not, and whether we want to be doing so or not. And if anyone has awareness that you have any connection with the Dharma and that you're seeking to live your life in that way, then you're on display. So, knowing not just you know, the general capacities of the people you're interacting with, but also knowing them personally. You know, in Agamo's community, you know, there are a lot of well-intended people that come to be there, but they're kind of out of whack. You know, they're not particularly well put together, and in some cases can be sort of kind of disruptive, need to be worked with carefully. All these people have different personality types and whatnot, so based on your own insights into yourself, your ability to read other people, I think there's some understanding what's going on with this person. Where are they coming from? Do they seem well grounded? Do they seem well focused? Do they seem troubled? Okay. What is, you know, if they have questions to ask or expressions they make, what is the question behind the question? What's the true question? What's the true statement underlying the statement? So out of our ability to gain insight into our own intentions and our own motivations comes the ability to read that in others. And these seven qualities that Buddha said are crucial not just to being able to live with some degree of personal integrity, but being able to manifest the Dharma in your connections with other people, even if you or any words are being said. And he sort of commends to us looking at those and thinking about them and reflecting on them, you know, as we live our daily lives. One of the things that occasionally plagues me, you know, is sort of self-doubt or kind of negative self-regard. And I recognize the thought pattern. For a long time I'd recognize the thought pattern and felt like, well, there it is again, not much I can do about it. But then at some point there came along another view that this, and it was a question born out of compassion, that was, is there any beneficial purpose whatsoever to be served by believing that thought? Any beneficial purpose at all? Which is different from self-reflection and self-examination and taking responsibility for unskillful words and deeds. But just this habitual default state of mind of self-recrimination, to the extent that that's just part of the personality, it doesn't serve any useful purpose at all. And it's a rather unkind way to regard oneself and to interact with oneself. And so I've found that when I'm really feeling pretty suspicious or down on myself, that tends to predispose me to see others the same way and to interact with them the same way. And when I am feeling more friendly toward myself in terms of like spiritual friendship, then I find that I'm at the very least able to sort of give the others the benefit of the doubt more than I might otherwise. You know, it's like that line from that W.H. Auden poem, you know, love your crooked neighbor with all your crooked heart. It's an awful lot of what this is about, isn't it? Okay, so that's the list. What do you think? Please.
So what did the Buddha say about the skill in the heart and dialogue?
What did he say about, I'm sorry, I can't hear the fan.
What did he say, or did he say anything about the skill and the art of engaging in dialogue?
Oh, a good question. What did he say about the skill and the art of engaging in dialogue? He actually had a fair amount to say about it. You know, he had his, especially, you know, when you're reading these discourses, there's a website called Access to Insight you can go to, and there is a few paragraphs of advice and counsel on how to read the discourses. know, things to stay mindful of, things to look out for. And among the things that is advised to look for is, who is the Buddha's audience? Who is the Buddha's audience? Who is he speaking to? There is some suspicion among Pali scholars now that the Buddha actually gave a lot of talks to lay people. But all of the talks the Buddha gave in his 45 years were all recorded, you know, mental, you know, in terms of memory, memorized by monks. And so they tended to be most interested in the discourses he gave to monks. And so we don't find very many discourses to lay people, although there are a few. So was he speaking to lay people? Was he speaking to monastics? Was he speaking, and whether lay people or monastics, was he speaking to people who were just starting out on the path, and just giving them a real simple, you know, square one feeling for things? Or was he speaking at a somewhat higher level for people that had had years and years of practice and of effort trying to live with his teachings? And when he was teaching his followers how to teach, that was one of the things that he put the most emphasis on. You know, this list here. Who are the people you're speaking with? In terms of advice on skillful speech generally, he had another list. You know, he had a 5-point list, which is, before engaging the mouth, okay, reflect on these factors, okay, but some of which are also drawn from this. Is my speech beneficially intended, or is the real intent to cause some kind of harm or discord? Is my speech useful, or is it idle gossip? Is my speech truthful or not? Is it intended to mislead? I might be ready to say something that is beneficially intended and useful and truthful, but it's not the right time to say it. So is it timely? That's a fourth factor to take into account. And then the fifth one is it kindly words, kindly spoken, or harsh words, harshly spoken? Because the latter negates everything that came before. So absolutely, the art of skillful speech is something the Buddha went at again and again and again, both in terms of how people interact with each other socially in community, especially monastic community, but just as importantly, how they teach the Dharma, and how they listen to questions about the Dharma.
I was wondering if you've never spoken about the silence that is necessary.
He said, you know, when he had achieved enlightenment and he was being encouraged to teach, he said, you know, that was a long haul. I'm not really sure anyone else, you know, I think others had the capability to do it. I just don't know if they want to, you know. And so he was beseeched to teach over and over again. And then when he looked around, he said, well, yes, I can discern that there are some who have just a little dust in their eyes, which means their view is somewhat obscure, but they have the capacity to learn the Dharma and for it to transform their lives. However, he said, they must be ready to listen. If they're not ready to listen with great care, no amount of words is going to be helpful. And likewise, when you're sharing the Dharma or discussing with others, the capacity to listen in a complete way is every bit as important. You know, when some of the advice I would get when I would be coming home from a retreat, especially one where I, you know, really had kind of a transformative effect and my worldview had just really been shifted in a discernible way. And I was really eager to go home and tell everyone about my experiences. You know, some of the teachers in the going home talk that you get, especially toward the end of a longer retreat, they would say, when you get home and somebody asks, how was your retreat? Said, listen for the question behind the question. Because it may be that all they really want to know is, oh yeah, fine, the food was great, slept well. And that's really all they want to know. They're just being polite. And then every once in a while, you'll get home from a retreat, and there'll be somebody who's really interested in the Dharma, and they really want to know what it was like. So you have to listen carefully for the intention underlying the question. And then you share knowledge with them in a very different way. And when we were being trained to teach, I think just as was the case back then, one of the most important points was always to listen for the question behind the question. Just as you listen to the meaning of the words of the question that's being asked, see if you can hear the question that's not being asked. And then sometimes if you ask the question back, you can do it in a slightly different way that will bring forth, you know, more of their intention, or maybe perhaps an intention that they had that weren't so real shy about sharing. Absolutely huge part of the teaching. Thank you. Please.
Really interested in the was it before? How much is enough?
Yes.
What an idea.
How much is enough food? How much is enough possessions? How much is enough speech?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would we Google seven qualities? Would access to insight have something to say about it?
Yes, you can go to Access to Insight, and then you can just input this Anguttaranikaya 7.68. I find it worth it, both because it's less expensive, but also because it's, you know, how I spend a lot of my time, actually, you know, studying the Dharma. I have electronic editions of all the Nikayas on my iPad and my computer, and because the in-print versions of the Anguttaranikaya, it's this means the numerical discourses tend to be excerpts because it's a complicated, pretty dense thing. But if you get the electronic version and you just go to the Book of the Sevens and you look for section 68, you'll find it. It doesn't even have a title. It's just, you know, Discourse, Book of the Sevens, section 68.
So I'm assigned entry bar on Google. What am I
going to
put in?
Well, you can just put in Anguttaranikaya. You may be able to find... Yes. Yes. So your Pali's a little shaky, is it? Okay. Anguttara. Anguttaranikaya. Nikaya. Yes, of course. Anguttara. Anguttara. Nikaya. Nikaya. You may find a full text version online someplace. If so, I hope it has search software. Otherwise, you can purchase Smita Bodhi's electronic edition online. One of the things I like about those discourses, the Anguttaranikaya, the Samyuttanikaya, the connected discourses, they're ones that are not spoken about so frequently. But a lot of them are really, really rich in information that kind of takes off where the Majjhima Nikaya ends. You know, we have some of these core, popular, well-known discourses. And then, like here, you know, the interface between intention and, you know, between the wisdom factors and the sila factors, you know, the pāṇya factors and the sila factors. That's what this discourse is about. You know, the preparation to take that step through the portal of intention into speech, action, and way of life. You know, to the ability, this is like how to prepare yourself to to be a manifestation and embodiment of the Dharma in the world. Really useful teachings, you know. You have a lot to say over 45 years. Other questions? Please go ahead.
So, Buddhism discourages being judgmental either of yourself or others, but it's still aspirational, right?
Oh, most surely. Most surely. There's a whole set of teachings that Buddha has called the Paramis, and it's translated most unfortunately, I think, as the perfections, you know. I think the aspirations might be just as good in terms of qualities of mind, sort of faith and courage and constancy and things of that nature that are really beneficial to cultivate. But I think that it is useful rather than sort of thou shalt, you know, and thou should thrash thyself about the head and shoulders if you don't perfect these, you know, right? But rather to think of them as kind of navigational aids, you know, like constellations, you know, and say, okay, where am I in relationship to that quality? Sometimes you'll just notice that it's there, you know. Sometimes when you're fearful and you'll see faith and equanimity arise, you know. You'll realize that you're experiencing courage, you know. In fact, this is probably worth us having a few talks about. But there are many aspirations that the Buddha, you know, the cultivation of the Brahma Vihara is a cultivation of compassion, selfless joy, and equanimity and open-heartedness. You know, those are definitely aspirational practices.
But instead of more studious route of some of the monotheist traditions, it seems like the idea is that it happens more organically through practice.
I'm sorry, did it happen?
It happens more organically through practice rather than studying the first six chapters of the Bible.
Yes, yes. And one of the distinctions that you'll find, and it's just a kind of a, I don't want to say doctrinal one even, but just kind of a thematically different way of looking at things. In the Mahayana tradition, you find something called the Alaya, or seed consciousness, and it's basically the teaching that there are all these seeds waiting to germinate and to manifest and whatnot. So you have all these seeds in your seed bed, like the Brahma Viharas and whatnot, as well as some of the unwholesome ones. And at one time, actually, in a conversation with Atanamaro, for some writing I was doing, I said, well, you know, in the Theravada tradition is a little bit more what he would call potentially existent, right? A little more subtle, and what he means by that is like the theories about how life first came into being on Earth. You know, that we had all these chemical ingredients floating around for the fabrication of proteins, but it needed some kind of energy source, and all of a sudden, you know, the lightning struck the pond or something and we were off to the races. It says a little bit more like that. The ingredients are all there, and then some spark occurs that brings things into being. And the spark is intention. It's right intention. You know, so if you have the intention to cultivate compassion and joy and equanimity and open-heartedness, and you've heard the teachings and you understand something about how to do it, then it indeed can manifest. And once you've experienced its manifestation, it becomes recognizable and it becomes easier to manifest it in the future. But the Pali word is bhavana, cultivation. You know, that it takes time and it takes patience and it takes constancy, and it can transform your life. Absolutely. The struggle, you know, when Tom Jeff talks about how, you know, you say, oh, okay, well, the origin of suffering is clinging, so I'm going to stop clinging. Right? Good luck with that one. He said, when you're starting off with, you know, on the path, he said, the first step is basically just trying to figure out how to get more strategic about your clinging. So instead of clinging, for the material things or whatever, getting high all the time, so you start clinging to the idea of becoming more compassionate, or clinging to the idea of being happy, or clinging to the idea of being more open-hearted. I say it's better than, clinging to weed, but it's still, clinging. And so gradually, so as long as you're clinging to the acquisition of, as long as you have an ideal of yourself as a yogi who ought to be more compassionate than I am, then that prohibits it from occurring. Because it's not really either your true self or your non-self, your true nature, that is seeking to be more compassionate. It's your ego. And the way the ego is trying to be more compassionate is by blaming yourself for not being more compassionate, right? Can't get there from here, doesn't work like that, And so that's where the shadow side of negative judgment comes in. I should have done that, I should have been more, I shouldn't have been so reactive. I should have been more compassionate. I shouldn't have cut that person off, right? Yada, yada, yada. And as soon as you see that that's what you're doing, then you can see that, admixed with the self-recrimination is somewhere in there, there's beneficial intent. You do want to be more compassionate. You do want to be happier. You just have to find a more skillful way to go about allowing that to happen. And it does unfold in its own time and place, as long as the intention is there. Okay, it's 8:00. Our gatekeeper needs to go home, so do we. So let's take just one moment and settle back into our sitting posture. As we go forth, may we live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we know ourselves and others with kind regard. May we rest in compassion, true joy, at peace with things as they are. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, at one with all beings, and may we be free. Have a safe journey home.